Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 167, entitled, How to Develop the Leadership Skills of a Navy SEAL, 10 Steps for Successful Leadership Execution, I chat with Brent Gleason. Brent Gleason is a Navy SEAL combat veteran, motivational speaker, leadership coach, and the author of the new best-selling book, Taking Point. In today's episode, Brent talks about his life in the Navy SEALs and the critical life lessons he learned while in this elite military branch. He shares his struggles, his triumphs, and a few crazy stories during his time as a Navy SEAL and helps us understand the key aspects needed to survive such a grueling profession. Perhaps most importantly of all, Brent gives us a step-by-step breakdown of how to become a great leader and successfully lead through any change. If you're wondering how you can become a great leader in your own life, how to improve your mental resolve in adverse conditions, and how to cultivate a badass Navy SEAL way of thinking, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. And now, a quick word from our fantastic sponsors. And by the way, all of our sponsors can be found in the show notes or at elitemanmagazine.com in the show's description, where you can click their links and check out the special offers they have for our Elite Man audience. The Elite Man Podcast is sponsored by HealthIQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/elite to support the show and see if you qualify. HealthIQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-minded individuals. You, being an Elite Man Podcast listener, are almost certainly among those health-conscious people. That's why you should really listen up. HealthIQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. So HealthIQ rewards you for being active and taking care of yourself. How cool is that? Look, you never know what's going to happen, especially if you're married, have children, or you've had personal scares or family members dealing with health issues. This is something you definitely cannot take lightly. It's so important to make sure your loved ones are kept safe no matter what, and HealthIQ helps you do that. It's the fastest growing life insurance company in the world with over $5 billion in coverage, and they're rated 9.6 out of 10 by Trustpilot. Do yourself and your family a huge favor and check out HealthIQ. To see if you qualify for an incredible savings of up to 33%, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/elite, or mention the promo code ELITE when you talk to a HealthIQ agent. Again, that's healthiq.com/elite. Can healthy be delicious? With Sunbasket, the answer is yes. Forget terrible protein shakes and flavorless diet food. Start cooking fresh, healthy, and delicious meals with organic produce, healthy antibiotic and hormone-free meats, pastured organic eggs, and fresh wild-caught seafood only with Sunbasket. Sunbasket is perfect for anyone who wants to eat healthier, isn't the greatest cook in the world, like me, doesn't want to have to shop around or look for difficult recipes to put together, and most importantly, for those who love eating great-tasting food. Each week, they deliver fresh, pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow recipes directly to your door in an insulated box from the meals you choose to try on their site. Everything is set up and done for you. You just have to cook it and eat it. How cool is that? I got to try some of their meals recently, and I have to say, I was really, really impressed. I tried out their Thai chicken recipe, their Moroccan chicken recipe, and their pepper and onion smothered steak with citrus salad recipe, and they were all tasty as hell. The best part is, I made it all myself in about half an hour, and it was incredibly easy. Trust me, I'm a terrible cook, but even I couldn't mess this up. If you're like me and you want to try a mouthwatering and nutritious meal that's really easy to make, go to sunbasket.com/elite today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/elite for $35 off your order. sunbasket.com/elite. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is Brent Gleason, a former Navy SEAL combat veteran and a motivational speaker currently. Brent, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, man. This is actually our second take. I just messed that up a minute ago, but we're back on. I want to talk in today's episode primarily about the leadership aspect. I know you have a book that you came out with recently that focuses primarily on about 10 steps or so for leadership execution, you know, business guys, executives, that kind of thing. Even regular people, I think, can take away a lot from this book. But before we dive into the leadership aspect, I interview Navy SEALs all the time, and they're some of the most fascinating guys on the planet. Literally, like, the most badass occupation you can have is a Navy SEAL. So before we talk about some of the principles in the book, some of the leadership aspects, can you talk for a minute about what drew you into wanting to become a Navy SEAL in the first place?
Sure, absolutely. And the book's actually only been out a month, and it's a bestseller. It was the number one new release in organizational change and business structural adjustment. So far, so good. And I appreciate the kind words. But as I said a minute ago, my wife reminds me every day how fascinating I am not. So we have people around us all the time keeping us humble. it's actually an interesting journey that led me down this path, as is just life in general. But I grew up in Dallas, Texas. I did my undergrad education at SMU, Southern Methodist University, earning degrees in finance and economics. During that time, I also studied at Oxford University in England, and never really had any aspirations of joining the military at all. I graduated SMU in 1999, so this was pre-9/11. It was peacetime, and those that were joining at that time were joining for all sorts of various reasons. I had some close friends. One of my roommates was joining the Navy to become an intelligence officer. But I also had a college buddy, a fraternity brother of mine, a year behind me in school, who had this vision and goal of joining the Navy to try out for the SEAL program. He wanted to be a SEAL. Now, he was one of those guys who kind of had a passion and interest in this his entire life, or since he was a young boy. And so I thought that was interesting. I thought it was a little unrealistic as a career path. So I wanted to do the finance thing, work for a couple of years, do my MBA, and live a long, boring life in Dallas. That was the plan. So while I was working in finance, and he was a senior, he was going to graduate and put an officer package in and join the Navy. And so we started training together. I'd been a college athlete. I played rugby at SMU. And so I wanted to find a way to stay fit. So he and I started training together to help him prepare for his journey. And therefore, we started spending a lot of time together almost on a daily basis and having a lot of dialogue about the SEAL teams and the history of the Naval Special Warfare community. And I became interested, so I started reading just about every book I could find on the history of the SEAL teams, from our inception during the underwater demolition teams in World War II to operations in Vietnam, Korea, Desert Storm, what have you, and just basically got sucked in, fascinated by the history, the culture, that type of mindset of being part of one of the most elite organizations, so to speak, in the world. And I guess that fascination coupled with the relatively boring nature of my entry-level financial analyst position led to the conclusion that I should live a life without regret. So one day I called my parents and told them I was quitting my job and joining the Navy. They were a little shocked by this dramatic transition, to say the least. I hadn't really had much conversation with them about this potential plan. So once they realized that I was very driven and passionate about pursuing this goal, they were very supportive. And so my buddy and I then moved to Crested Butte, Colorado. My parents used to have a house up there. So we moved there and trained for an additional 6 months for about 5 hours a day, every single day, at 10,000 feet altitude. So high altitude training, so we can get into the best physical condition that we could. And then in early 2000, joined the Navy. And after a couple months of basic training, was on a plane out here to San Diego, California, to begin that journey. I joined BUDS class. BUDS is the first 6 months of the SEAL training pipeline. Stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL. I joined BUDS class 235, and of the well over 200 that started, about 23 of us graduated, went to our respective teams. Now, during that time, after BUDS, there was about a week before we started the advanced portion of training, or SQT, which is SEAL qualification training. 2 days before we started SQT was 9/11. So that was, wow. As you can imagine, an instantaneous mindset, cultural, and structural transformation that began within the special operations community. And so that really, again, changed the entire approach and mindset of what a career in the SEAL teams would look like. And everybody, of course, always takes the training very seriously, but now is a totally next level type of seriousness, knowing that we would in fact be going to war. And I was assigned to SEAL Team 5, other teams had spun up and gone off to Afghanistan. Then word came down the pipeline that Iraq was imminent, and my task unit from SEAL Team 5 was actually the very first SEAL task unit deployed into Iraq in the spring of 2003, literally right after Baghdad fell. And we were there to operate mostly in and around Baghdad, Ramadi, Fallujah, performing what we call capture or kill missions, basically hunting down the guys on the deck of cards, a blacklist, other various insurgent faction leaders. Long story short, did several combat tours, a couple in Iraq, Africa, some other places, and then hadn't planned on doing it as a career. And back then, you know, if I'd had a crystal ball, I probably would have stayed in longer, but everybody just assumed these conflicts could not possibly last much longer, or especially not as long as they've lasted, yet here we are. I've got buddies who've, you know, career SEALs have done 15 combat tours. It's almost unimaginable. But I stuck to my plan and got out and went to graduate school, and also didn't really have any aspirations of being an entrepreneur, but yet that also happened. So I met my former business partner in grad school and built and sold a couple companies since then, and have been building this leadership management consulting practice over the last 5 years, and a lot of speaking and consulting and workshops. I do it all over the world, usually about 70 to 75 events a year. And last year, the goal was to, after I'd sold my previous company, so the 2017 goal was to write the book and continue to build a brand around Taking Point Leadership. And the book, which is titled Taking Point, essentially is a business transformation book. So it's teaching leaders how to more successfully navigate the murky waters and uncertainty of leading change in pretty much any organization. To your point earlier, the principles in the book can be applied to a business, to a sports team, a nonprofit organization, personally, professionally, even within a family dynamic. So it's the principles are housed within key learnings and case studies and things like that from a business perspective, but you really can draw some deep insight from it in almost any aspect of life.
Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting things you mentioned for sure in that brief description. I want to just kind of ask a couple specifics on in terms of like timeline stuff. So how old were you exactly when you entered the Navy, and how long did you stay in the Navy in terms of like years, regular Navy, and then how long were you in the Navy SEALs?
Sure. I was about 23. I worked for a year after graduating college. So I guess I was about 23 once I joined the Navy, or had just turned 23. And I was not ever in the regular Navy. So I went to, like a lot of guys do, you have a choice. You can, if you've done your undergrad education, you can put an officer package together, go to OCS, and then try to get a billet to go to BUDS, which is very competitive. Because there's, in large part, just because there's only so many slots for officers in each class. We run six classes a year. A class will start with a couple hundred guys, 250 guys, but there may only be 20, 25 slots for officers. And the Naval Academy gets about half of those, and then people who went to college and OCS will get the other half of those, or respectively something around that. So you might successfully get a billet to go to BUDS, but your class might not. You might get a class that's a year or two out. Especially these days with how competitive it is to get in. So what a lot of guys do will enlist as opposed to going in as an officer. And now it's about 75% of our enlisted guys have at minimum an undergrad education. So really kind of a totally different makeup than you might imagine from a military perspective. So my buddy and I we put our officer packages together, and then we were debating, and then finally we just dumped them in the trash, enlisted, and went to boot camp. I'll be honest, boot camp, regular Navy boot camp, was a massive culture shock for someone who was 23 and had gone to college and worked in finance. So I immediately thought I'd just made the biggest mistake of my life. But boot camp flies by. It's, you know, it's only a few months. And so from boot camp, you basically went straight to BUDS. Had like a week or two off, came back to Dallas to regroup, and then hopped on a plane and headed out here. And I was in San Diego for 12 hours before I checked into BUDS. So I was never in the regular Navy per se, and then I served in the SEAL teams for almost 6 years, and also was planning that transition out to even before my last combat tour. So I took the GMAT and had applied and got into grad school, and then went off to Africa, and then came back. And a week after I got out of the Navy, I started grad school. So all these very quick transitions in my life thus far.
Yeah. Wow, man. It seems like you just kind of pick things up and go when you decide you want to do something, which is pretty intense. What was the toughest part of being a Navy SEAL? Was it the training beforehand? Was it the boot camp stuff? Was it, you know, the initial culture shock of it? Was the actual training like later on for the Navy SEALs the toughest part? Or was it actually being a Navy SEAL and performing some of the missions?
It's a good question, because there's largely a misconception that it's the SEAL training in the early months and Hell Week and all that that's the most difficult part, which obviously is very difficult. We have the highest attrition rate of any special operations training program out there. And Hell Week, of course, is certainly the crucible that all SEALs share. And we had a unfortunate experience my class did during Hell Week. We actually had our class leader, who's the highest ranking officer in your class, all officers enlisted in the class go through the exact same experiences, but he actually passed away. So that was sort of an early entree into what life in the SEAL teams could potentially be like. But people don't really realize that the daily grind of the training and the lifestyle in the teams is really harder. I mean, you're working long days, long deployments, and when you're not on deployment, you're off training somewhere. So it's hard on the operator, it's hard on the family, it's hard on the children. So it's really sort of an accumulation of the overarching grind of that lifestyle and that work environment that's difficult. I mean, definitely, again, the early phases of training in Hell Week are very challenging. But, I most would agree that in large part, the training is more difficult once you get to a team.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the ways you handle that stress, like deal with the constant pressure of being a Navy SEAL and the unknown of like what's going to happen next? And how do you keep yourself grounded in the moments of being, say, deployed, or even in, you know, some of the training things that you had to do, which you referred to Hell Week, which everyone considers just being one of the toughest training times of anyone's life? Like, how do you deal with yourself and keep yourself grounded in those tough moments?
Well, that's another great question, because that is one of the things you learn to accept your life in Hell Week, and those months of training is largely physical, but it's really more about mental transformation and learning how to embody the appropriate mindset that aligns with achieving that singular vision, which the first step is to become a SEAL. So just through that training alone, organically, you start to learn how to stress, you learn how to compartmentalize, you learn how to maintain not just mental toughness, but even more so a positive mental attitude. And I distinctly remember some of the worst evolutions during Hell Week. And those of us who could plaster on a smile and laugh through the misery, because it's almost incomprehensible how miserable you are, it's those who can find humor in those moments and knowing that you're creating these memories you're going to have forever, which later become fond memories. They're not really fond memories at the moment, of course, but you're learning and being taught how to, as we say in the SEAL teams, embrace the suck. You're learning how to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And that only grows and continues to develop as you deploy and go to war and go to combat and apply those skills in very dangerous, chaotic environments. And you're learning how to lead through chaotic environments. You're learning how to move, shoot, and communicate concisely with a team, make decisions amidst uncertainty and adversity, all these things that are critical to being a special operator. But really, that mindset transformation starts on day one of BUDS and flows on into SQT and then platoon-level training once you get to a team. It's a constant professional and personal development that you're going through. So you learn how to embody these new ways of thinking about the reality of the world around you, and are able to successfully apply those in your work environment as an operator, and then later on in the civilian world as a leader in the business world or whatever profession you take on later on.
Is there some type of placebo mentally when you're undertaking some of these incredibly difficult tasks? Like, is there sort of a meditative-like state you undergo or some type of switch mentally that clicks on for you, or is it just a constant state of, like you said, kind of building yourself up over time and you get used to it as time progresses?
I think that happens organically. I'm speaking for myself. I know that I've spoken to other guys who will sort of make a conscious effort to launch themselves into more of a meditative state, but I found it to be also very much organic. When you're dealing with stress or a chaotic situation or uncertainty and trying to make decisions and communicate effectively, it's more so about compartmentalization and slowing things down. Another one of our many, many sayings in the SEAL teams is slow is smooth and smooth is fast. Don't run to your death, so to speak. Essentially, on an enemy target, that means take it slow, assess risk, make decisions, and use speed and aggression when necessary. And that applies in your professional life, your personal life, when you can really slow things down and take each moment as they come, even though you're in combat. Of course, things are moving at the speed of war and it feels like it's going by, a mile a minute. But at the same time, you really have to prioritize your goals and the objectives you're trying to achieve. And tackle those priorities one at a time. Because if you're trying to think about too many things at once and make too many decisions all at once, you're going to just make a heap load of bad decisions and miscommunications and things launch into chaos. So it's really more just about that natural progression of slowing things down, prioritization and execution.
Cool, man. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk now about the leadership component of things. I know leadership is certainly a big aspect to being a Navy SEAL and the whole teamwork thing, like working with other people, having their back, they have your back. It's really a critical part of any operation of a successful mission. Was that sort of what led you into developing your training now, is with the motivational speaker thing, but also more of the leadership coaching? Did that directly come from being a Navy SEAL?
That's certainly where it started. Yeah, one of the interesting things about the SEAL community and special operations in general, and these days the military in its entirety, is this post 9/11 reality that we all exist in, and being in a constant state of change and transformation, which leadership alone, especially leadership in dynamic situations, is essentially one of the hardest things to learn and master. But leadership amidst change is 10 times harder. And that's a situation we've been in the special operations community now for 17 years. And so you learn how to lead in chaotic situations. And we have a philosophy of leadership at all levels. We have essentially, and even though you have rank in the military, we have more of what you might refer to as a flat management structure. We're very good at disseminating true leadership responsibilities down the chain of command, so we can operate in more of a decentralized command model, so we can decentralize decision-making and communication. Because one of the interesting correlation I draw in the book and in a lot of my writings for Forbes and Inc. and a lot of the presentations I do is, if you think about it, we as a military in its entirety enter these conflicts after 9/11 essentially as a very traditional organizational structure, very top-down, very command and control, very siloed, both vertically and horizontally. We were a slow-moving 20th century organization. And we quickly realized that we were not fighting the same organizational structure. We're, of course, fighting a very decentralized enemy, a very agile enemy. And we realized that to move at the speed these wars required and to sustain that fight against a decentralized enemy, we too would really have to start restructuring ourselves as an organization, new process, new systems, new communication strategies, and even transforming our mindset and culture to really embrace a more agile approach to military operations and military structure, which of course is kind of the antithesis of what you would think of when you think military. So essentially, we had to transform ourselves into a modern 21st century organization, just like today's leaders and business organizations and organizations all over the world are having to do just to sustain in this more modern, disruptive global business landscape. So it really started there, but one of the things, and a lot of people get out there and they'll speak about military leadership and try to draw some loose correlations is how that can apply in the civilian world, but unless you've really done it, unless you've really applied those principles in building your own organizations or leading other organizations, it's kind of hard to be prescriptive in the manner and how you can teach that into other people and organizations. So when I was in grad school and starting my first company, and very blessed. Both of those initial companies doubled in size every single year, so very rapidly growing companies, both Inc. 500 list every year after year. But both of those organizations were rapidly growing companies in even faster changing industries. So it came with a lot of constant change, constant shifting dynamics, and having to lead those organizations through significant transformations, and sometimes even constant change and transformation, which is what I write about a lot in my columns, as well as what the book is about. It's about successfully leading organizational change. So, like I said, leadership alone is very difficult to master, but leading amidst change is one of the more difficult things that I've ever experienced. And a lot of my quote-unquote wisdom really just comes from a long line of very costly mistakes that I've made. It's really more so about teaching others not to make the same mistakes. But it was an interesting evolution. When I started writing for Forbes, I'd written a couple of the columns. I'd only had the column for a month or two. But out of the blue, so to back up, really, I'm very passionate not just about the companies I started, about building organizations as a whole and leadership in its entirety, and studying about it, reading it, and writing about it. And one day out of the blue, it was a Saturday morning, I was checking my email, and I got an email from the president of Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, Asia Pacific region. So one of the top four executives in the entire global organization. And he had just read literally the first article that I had written for my Forbes column. Yeah, it was called From the Battlefield to the Boardroom. And he's a great guy. We're now very close friends. We're godparents to each other's children. And he's only 46 today, so 41 years old, and one of the highest ranking executives in a global bank. And he, just a super highly energetic, fitness obsessed Australian guy that rose up in the ranks in the banking world, but also very obsessed with the culture of the special operations community, and not just the SEALs, but just in general. And he loved how I draw correlations between those principles of what Forge SEAL culture and those shared values, and how you can apply those in creating successful organizations in the business world. And he asked me to come out and do a series of keynote presentations and workshops at their global leadership conference in Hong Kong, which was the following month. He didn't ask if I was a speaker. He didn't ask to see any videos or testimonials or a website, anything. Just the fact that I was a SEAL was good enough for him. So being an entrepreneur, of course, I said yes. And then I remember sending the email, and I turned to my wife. I was like, oh, crap. I don't know what the hell I just committed to, but I need to learn how to be a speaker really fast. And again, long story short, I prepared relentlessly for it, of course, and it went very well. And they had me back to Singapore and Sydney the following month. And I've done that Asia Pacific tour every year since then. And just, I found a passion for it. And I found a passion for writing about leadership, studying leadership, teaching leadership, with other organizations. And I've doubled the frequency of that, speaking and consulting events every year since then. And that's what one of the primary reasons I sold the company in late 2016. My last company was to go all in on this leadership and management consulting practice and write the book and build a curriculum around that for ongoing consulting with organizations and teaching organizational transformation and employee engagement and aligning culture with strategy and all the things that I write about in the book.
Have you tried a Casper sleep product yet? If not, check it out now. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. Casper products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. The experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. They also have a breathable design that helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is becoming the internet's favorite mattress. You spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should definitely be comfortable when you do it. With hassle-free returns, if you're not completely satisfied, you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. Act now and get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/elite and using the promo code ELITE at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's casper.com/elite and use the promo code ELITE at checkout.
So the book itself is called Taking Point. What is
taking point actually mean? Is that a Navy SEAL term?
Well, taking point, for example, when you're on patrol in enemy territory, the man in front is the point man. He's taking point. He's essentially leading the team through volatile, uncertain environments. There's another acronym we have in the military, which is VUCA, V-U-C-A, and it refers to the volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous environments that we operate in. Ironically, that acronym is now widely used in the global business community, and for good reason, because of all the disruption and the fast-paced, dynamic, uncertain business environment that we're pretty much all a part of today in any organization, any industry, large or small. And so I use that sort of military reference for the title of the book, because the book essentially is about leading organizational change, leading in volatile, uncertain environments.
I have in front of me the 10 steps for the book. I want to just go through them quickly and then dive into maybe a few specifics and kind of elaborate on a couple of them, if that's cool. The 10 steps as I have them in here, and correct me if I'm missing one or if I jumbled one up, but it looks like it's culture, trust, accountability, mindset, preparation, transmission, inclusion, fatigue, discipline, and resiliency. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
All right, cool. Let's start with the first one, actually, because I think this is interesting. What is the culture? What does that actually mean? Can you elaborate a little more on why this is the first principal step that you have for leadership?
Sure. And to back up, especially for those listening who don't have that right in front of them, those 10 chapters and those 10 principles are divided into three parts. And the first part is about building a change culture. So essentially, transforming an organizational culture to be more accepting, if not even embracing, change. So not just about reactively dealing with the changes any organization faces today or almost every day, but building a resilient organization that's agile and adaptive and embraces change and uses it to their advantage. And a lot of these things, of course, require process and structural transformations, but all of that has a cultural implication on an organization. And the problem, and one of the reasons that about 70% of organizational transformation efforts either fail or fall short of meeting their objectives, and that's according to last year's McKinsey data, in large part is because organizations and their leaders run off and run to their death, as we say in the SEAL teams, and they start on step 5 or 6, forgetting steps 1 through 4 or 5. And a lot of those steps are foundational. Is a culture in any team or organization is going to come about in two ways. Either by design or, more typically, a bit hazardly over the years of the team of people who are coming and going within an organization. So that's why I started the book really laying that foundation for culture. And there's implications of culture throughout the entire book, because, ironically, culture transformation, even though I have it starting as the first principle, it's really to lay that foundation, because culture transformation doesn't typically really solidify until the latter stages of an organizational transformation effort. And usually those transformation efforts take a lot longer than we anticipate, because there's a lot of structural change, there's a lot of process change, but until it takes a lot of time for those mindsets, beliefs, and behaviors to become ingrained in the culture. But when they do, then you have a true successful culture transformation. So I write in the first chapter about really understanding what is the culture that we have in our organization, what are the strengths of that culture. So how can you really audit your culture, so to speak, and do a cultural diagnostic analysis is what I refer to in the book. Understanding the strengths of that culture that will be prime movers for change, understanding the weaknesses of your culture that don't align with the new vision or that will impede progress, so to speak, and understanding how to improve those weaknesses or mitigate those weaknesses so you can leverage culture to drive change within the organization.
Cool. So the next one we have, I guess, is trust. What is trust all about? Why is that important to leadership and teamwork?
Well, so part one about building a change culture is I talk about culture, but then I talk about what I believe to be, and a lot of studies support this, to be the two most important cultural pillars in an organization, which are trust and accountability. Specifically speaking about trust, we're talking about the two aspects of trust, which are, there's internal trust, of course, trust amongst the team, trust that peers have, trust that leaders have for their team, and the trust that the team has for their leaders and managers. But also taking it to a much more granular level and understanding how to measure and improve trust, and understanding the financial and economic impact trust has on an organization, or just the impact trust has on productivity in a team environment in general. One of the unfortunate stories that I referenced in that chapter is about the passing of our class leader during Hell Week. We were about, I'll tell you how Hell Week starts on a Sunday and ends on a Friday afternoon. But the glorious aspect of that Sunday is the class reports to the classroom with a couple required possessions. But the great thing is the students do not know when Hell Week's going to start. They don't know what's called breakout. So you're just sitting there all day, just the anguish and stress eating away at your soul. And John, who was our class leader, I remember one of the ways to inspire and motivate us was he read us the St. Crispin's Day speech from William Shakespeare's Henry V. And one of the famous lines from that speech is, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother." And John died 4 days after that moment. And it was about Thursday night, it's about 11 p.m. We were in the pool doing relay races, and he essentially had a massive heart failure and drowned in the pool right next to us. But when we were assembled in the classroom about an hour or two later, and the commanding officer came in to deliver the news and to address the class, I don't remember all the exact words because of the exhaustion and stress of the moment and the years that have passed, but I do remember distinctly him focusing on the concept of team trust and the importance of trust, which was kind of also an odd bit of foreshadowing because several months later was 9/11, when we all knew we'd be going to war where trust amongst the team would be at an absolute premium. So I draw that correlation between not just trust that you must have with your team members in a combat scenario, but the trust we have to have and build and measure and improve in our organizations in order to be successful, in order to grow, in order to improve employee engagement, in order to essentially achieve growth and positive financial returns.
And how do you, what's the quickest way to build that trust from the get-go?
Well, there's several parts. And of course, from a very high level, you can say that, well, trust has to be part of the culture. Like anything else in an organization, from a leadership perspective, all of these things essentially have to start at the top. If your leaders are not trustworthy people, both on and off the battlefield, so to speak, then you're not going to be able to build trust in any team or organization. So it starts with really trust and integrity of leadership, both inside and outside of the office, both on and off the battlefield. It starts with organizations taking an active pursuit of investing in respect, and therefore teams can engage in what I refer to as respectful conflict, and using that ability to have really respectful, transparent communication. You don't always have to agree with one another. That's not what trust is all about. But if you can build respect in an organization, in a team, you can have respectful conflict and use that conflict to navigate problems and develop solutions. And there's plenty of other activities and ways you can create that result of having a trustworthy organization. And the foundation of it is really the cultural experiences that you have in place in your organization that builds trust. And I don't mean, you know, team building activities and all those types of things. Those are great. But I mean the day in, day out behaviors that drive trust. You know, there's behaviors that build trust. There's behaviors that damage trust. And as leaders, we get the behaviors that we tolerate. So if we're not acting in a trustworthy manner, those behaviors are going to permeate the team. And if we tolerate untrustworthy behavior and a lack of integrity and a lack of teamwork and collaboration, then that's what we're going to have as part of our culture. But if we don't tolerate that and we remove untrustworthy people, we talk about trust, we reward trustworthy behavior, then it's going to be part of your culture.
And how does the accountability play into this? I'm sure it goes right along with trust, and you mentioned that trust and accountability go right along with the culture and setting the tone of things. How does the accountability work in that regard?
Yeah, no, accountability is also another critical cultural pillar for any successful team or organization. One of the correlations I draw is how we instill accountability in our culture and the SEAL teams. And really, again, that starts on day one of our training. And it, as we say, our training is never complete. But one of the ways we do that, again, one of our rituals, our cultural experiences that supports the aspect of accountability is weekly anonymous peer reviews. So we'll, just like organizations will do anonymous 360 reviews of their leaders, managers, peers, et cetera, we also have a pretty significant peer review process where, and they do this at the regular team level and at the tier one level as well, where you're essentially, you know, ranking the top performers in your class and you're ranking the bottom performers in your class, and you're given the opportunity to not just list who, but list why you believe that. And the instructors correlate and cross-reference that information with their own data that they have on each student, and use that data pretty significantly in their decisions to keep or drop or remove a student. And the interesting thing about those peer reviews is you don't have people landing at the bottom of the list because they're not the fastest runner, or they're not the fastest swimmer, or the best shooter in the kill house. Typically, it's more of a lack of discipline, a lack of accountability. They're not good communicators. They have an ego problem. They're not trustworthy individuals. Essentially, long story short, they're not someone you'd want to be standing next to in a gunfight in a dangerous environment. So it's those types of behavioral elements that get guys listed in those bottom echelons of the class, as opposed to being top performers who are the guys who lead by example. They go above and beyond. They put the team and their teammates before themselves. They act in a trustworthy manner. They're disciplined and accountable. They're accepting of feedback, both from not just the instructors, but from their peers. That's also a big part of our culture and how we instill accountability, is peer-to-peer learning and peer-to-peer feedback. When we finish a mission or a training scenario, you know, we perform every single time without fail, and without waiting, we perform an AAR, or after action review. But and business organizations call it a postmortem, and then there's different ways that organizations do it. But one of the unique ways that we do it is by, and again, also the antithesis of what you might think of as in a military organization, is it doesn't always work this way, but we essentially try to leave rank and emotion at the door. We go into that room as equals, regardless of rank, regardless of who's going to say what. It's part of our learning culture. It's part of our ritual to instill accountability. So it doesn't matter what your rank or your tenure in the SEAL teams, everybody's encouraged to have a voice, speak up, and have actionable takeaways and insights so that we can be in a constant state of improvement. You got to have thick skin, because your team members will hold you accountable, and if you made a mistake, you will be called out in front of everybody. It's not the way civilian organizations really probably should do it, because there's human resource issues involved. But the way we do it is brutal, honest transparency, and we engage in respectful conflict to solve problems and develop new solutions and become better. And that's how we learn, that's how we grow, and that's how we hold ourselves accountable.
Are there leaders? I mean, that brings up an interesting point right there. Are there leaders within? I mean, every Navy SEAL, as far as I'm concerned, is an incredible leader, and they are able to lead many different teams and organizations and just be an exceptional leader across the board. But are there leaders within that group of leaders? Are there leaders within the SEAL team, like, that other people kind of hold in higher regard in terms of their opinion and their philosophy? Or, like you said before, is everything equal and everybody is the same?
No. There's. It's a good question, because there's. I don't want to give the depiction that there's a lack of diversity and everybody's the same and everybody's held to the highest regard. Just like any other organization, our culture is not perfect. Our leaders aren't always perfect. We're all flawed in many ways. But sure, there are always certain leaders that stand out, and in large part due to the qualities that we've been talking about in this podcast. By leading by example, by being trustworthy and accountable and maintaining a positive mental attitude and being able to stay calm under pressure, and all these key qualities that people really respect, and people, the type of person that you want to follow into battle, that you want to support, that you would give your life for. But one of the things I always say when asked about that is, you know, regardless of, you know, officer, enlisted, rank, tenure, you know, my heroes are the leaders that gave their lives for their teammates. There's no other, just like it says in the Bible, there's no other greater love than to lay down your life for your brother, for your teammate. And that is about as high a volume as it gets in leading by example, when you are willing to sacrifice yourself for your team.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, man. And anyone who's in the military at all, especially guys like the Navy SEALs, I have the utmost respect for putting their life on the line, you know, each and every day. And their many years of service, for sure, it's an incredible sacrifice they make. In terms of the next couple of steps, we have mindset, preparation, transmission. Is there any one of those? I want to cover a few more of these, but I know what our times are coming up soon. But mindset, preparation, transmission, any one of those that particularly stand out as something you think the audience would appreciate, our Elite Man audience would appreciate?
Yeah, I'd like to cover mindset transformation because
it's kind of the one
first chapter. Yeah, good. And I specifically made it the first chapter, second part for the change. And for example, going back to SEAL training, it's in large part more about mindset transformation and aligning your mindset with achieving a lofty goal. So any organizational transformation or change effort is a lofty goal in any regard, regardless of the size or type of organization. And oftentimes it starts with leaders really trying to better understand whether or not they can help them lead the team through those uncertain waters of change and through adversity and ensure that they fulfill that vision, whatever that vision is. So again, with navigating the complexities of SEAL training and the pain that you go through, you really, and it goes back before you even join the Navy. I remember when I made that decision to join the Navy and try out for the SEAL program, it started with a total mindset transformation, meaning I need to change my mindset and behaviors and my priorities so that I can achieve that goal, meaning I needed to change my social life. I needed to change or remove people and activities that would stand in the way of that goal. The same thing applies to organizational change. Leaders have to make sure that they have the mindset to lead that company or organization all the way through to the end. And that starts because if they don't change their mindset and align that mindset with the vision and strategy and what they're trying to achieve, then there's no way that mindset shift is going to permeate the entire team and organization, which it really has to, which is why leading change is so difficult in pretty much any organization. So I draw some correlations there between SEAL training and mindset shift and transformation and how leaders must and can and should and how they can shift their mindset towards aligning, you know, with the new reality of what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, no, I love it, man. Definitely having that belief in what you're doing is going to work, the belief in the mission that it's going to be successful. Yeah. And I think it's critical and certainly one of the most important points on this list. Preparation, of course, comes down to gathering intelligence, getting the information you need, planning the mission. Transmission is more of the communicating the vision, right? Like getting that across to your team members, to the people you're trying to lead. The next one is inclusion, which I think is pretty interesting. I think it's interesting in terms of, as far as I understand it, like getting other people involved in the mission and having them actually actively participate. Can you talk about that for a minute and why that's important to get everybody on board?
Yeah, it's a very important piece of any transformation effort because it's quite challenging. I mean, according to last year's Global Gallup research, employee disengagement in organizations is at a whopping 67%. Only 15% of the workforce can be defined as engaged, meaning we're emotionally connected to our work and we have a clear and concise understanding of how our day-to-day work and activities drive mission success to the organization. We have a go above and beyond attitude. Well, the majority of most workforces are disengaged. The problem is those folks are kind of hard to identify because oftentimes they're relatively happy. You know, they're punching in, they're punching out, they're collecting a paycheck. They're doing their work. They're not necessarily doing a great job or going above and beyond or have a collaborative team-focused mindset. And then there's, you know, the 18% who are actively disengaged, meaning they're working against the team or organization. But organizational change can only be successful and lasting with the participation and inclusion of the majority of people in an organization. And that's one area where leaders often make that mistake is they make a lot of decisions and put their strategic plan together, their mission plan, so to speak, but they do it with two or three people in a room and a whiteboard and then just tell everybody what's going to be going on without gathering critical ground intelligence from their frontline troops, their frontline managers, other subject matter experts within their organization, and not getting that feedback and those ideas and that critical data and information that often gets trapped in those silos in any organization. They just make decisions without that information. And what that does is it doesn't give the team the perspective that they have a voice. It doesn't give them that opportunity to have that buy-in and have that understanding and know that, well, my opinion is valued and I have all this great information because I'm the subject matter expert in this critical area. Well, nobody consulted me, so why should I support this plan? Because I don't even believe in a plan because a lot of the aspects of the plan are missing critical components. So one of the ways we plan missions in the special operations community is to include the majority of people on a team or in a troop or a platoon, or using our intelligence assets so that we can have as much data as possible. So we have a data-driven process to making decisions and making that mission plan. And when you do that, when organizations do it successfully, you're accomplishing those two things. You're gaining critical information and data that's used to make informed decisions, to develop those contingency plans. But also, you're gaining that buy-in, and that buy-in and participation is absolutely critical throughout the transformation process. Because oftentimes, you're gonna lose some buy-in even from the early adopters, because transformation takes a lot longer than you anticipate. It's usually a little more painful than we think it's gonna be. So people will kind of be like, you know what? I don't think this is working. I believed in it, but now I kind of don't, and I'm gonna regress back into my bunker and kind of wait and see what happens. But when you can have really engaged people involved in that mission planning process for the transformation journey, you're also creating these change evangelists, so to speak, these people who can be deployed to the edges of an organization, really getting other team members engaged and energized and understanding what that mission narrative is and why they should believe in that mission narrative, going back to the importance of leadership belief in the mission. If the leaders don't believe in the mission, nobody else is going to believe in the mission, and nobody's going to be engaged or want to participate in what that mission is going to be, because they're not going to want to follow any of those leaders into that change battle. And that's why participation is so important, because it takes the energy and activity and engagement of the majority of a workforce to successfully lead through change.
Yeah, no, I love that, man. I think it's a really important step. And I think it's one often overlooked in terms of leadership, is getting everybody engaged, you know, and feedback, getting everyone's perspective, yep, getting more information, like you said, and then also boosting the morale of the team in general. Like, people want to be heard. They want to hear like their voices is heard and that they're participating. I'm sure this goes right along with the next couple of steps as well, with the fatigue and the discipline. But how do you keep people from getting fatigued aside from inclusion? How do you keep them from keeping up that energy and staying motivated? And then, you know, also just touching on the other one, the ninth step, which is the discipline, having them focus and follow through on the mission consistently. Like, how do you keep their spirits up and keep them working hard?
Well, sure. Going back to the point I made about organizational change and transformation usually takes longer than managers and leaders and the team anticipates. It usually has more significant hard and soft costs than we anticipate. And I've experienced, again, this in my own failures as a leader in my organizations. One of the ways you can lessen what I refer to as change battle fatigue in the book, there's several ways you can do it. You're starting foundationally with the engagement of the team and gaining that buy-in, so that you can essentially say to the team, let's all embrace the suck together. This is going to be painful. This is going to take a long time, but we can do this together, because you're defining the win and you're giving them a way to visualize what the bright, shiny future is going to look like. And when you can do that, you're starting off on the right foot. You're getting people envisioning the win, envisioning what the better organization is going to look like. They're going to want to be a part of it. But then you kind of go on about your way and start implementing the plan. And the problem is, we're oftentimes piling on all of these other competing priorities on top of the already full workload that our team has. So they still have to do their day-to-day tasks of the things they get measured on, the things that support the customer, the client, what have you. But then they also have five other new priorities, or new systems to learn, new process to learn, new ways to be, a mindset shift, all these things that cause change battle fatigue. And when you're months in or years into a transformation effort and it's kind of hard to see the finish line, or the finish line continues to look further and further away, then people get very discouraged, and change is intensely personal. It causes fear. It causes uncertainty when leaders aren't properly communicating and continually communicating the vision. So one of the ways you can do that during that mission planning process is to identify, if not even manufacture, those early successes and those quick wins that people can celebrate. You can tell the story of how you created that quick win and how that quick win drives the progress towards a successful transformation. So projects, projects or milestones that you can identify at even the 3-month mark, but more specifically the 6-month, 12-month, 18-month mark, that you can put teams and task forces together and give them the resources to execute those milestones, and those milestones directly drive, you know, transformation success. Then you publicly celebrate that win. and you tell, you know, through formal and informal channels, you can tell that story. And that goes into kind of the second piece of not just the quick wins and early successes, but purposeful storytelling, so that you can continually, almost on a day-to-day basis, again, formally or informally, tell the story of how progress is being made towards this transformation mission. You know, and that could be standing at the water cooler in the break room. It could be in a company meeting. It could be in a company-wide email. But even more importantly, more informal storytelling, so that people can continue to not lose sight of the win that they could see in the early stages of transformation. So identifying those quick wins, purposeful storytelling, celebrating the new mindsets and behaviors that people are starting to embody, all doing all of that will mitigate change battle fatigue. It'll also help bring some of those naysayers who didn't adopt this transformation vision early on, essentially bring them into light and help them understand that we are making progress towards this mission plan. We are making progress towards fulfilling our vision. And, you know, I want to be a part of that too.
Yeah, no, I love that, man. Brent, that was, you know, one of the coolest ones, I think, of all the steps, is keeping people motivated, keeping people's eye on the future and giving them that feedback that they're going and heading towards the right way. I think that hope and knowing that they're doing the right things is going to keep them motivated and keep them engaged. Real quickly, the last step, resiliency. You mentioned it's the path of lasting change. What's that about? And just kind of elaborate quickly on the resiliency aspect, the final step.
Sure. Yeah, it really goes back to another important layer of going through a transformation, because most organizations today are not going to go through one significant transformation. They'll probably go through multiple changes or transformation efforts in the lifespan of the organization, or be in a constant state of change, depending on what kind of organization they are and what kind of industry and how disruptive it is. So it's not just about reactively dealing with the changes our organizations face today, but building a resilient and agile organization that has the mindset, the skills, the training, and resources to adapt and evolve and deal with the changes we'll face tomorrow. So some of the pillars of resilient organizations that I talk about in that chapter are, you know, most agile, resilient organizations of the 21st century have leaders and team members who embrace just a little bit of healthy paranoia. They're never satisfied with the status quo. We're always looking to the horizon for threats and opportunities and areas where we might adjust, or new products to roll out. Not in a disorganized, non-prioritized way, but just a little bit of healthy paranoia is good for a resilient organization. We're always redefining the goals, moving the goalposts. We're always providing and investing in personal and professional development for the team, always giving the team the resources they need to have to adopt new process, new systems, and really in a constant state of analysis of the culture of our organization, the mindset of the team, understanding the levels of engagement of the team. These are things that resilient organizations are constantly analyzing. They're very data-driven in their approach to understanding the current state of the union, so to speak, and what the organization needs to look like a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, and then constantly using that data, information, and feedback to make not necessarily always large adjustments, but even little incremental adjustments so the organization can continue to adapt. So those are just a few of the pillars and elements of agile organizations, and it's what it looks like in the special operations community. It's what the best organizations out there that deal with change well, it's how they're structured and how they think, and that's what most organizations today are hopefully at least striving to become, is to become resilient and embody a grit and be able to bounce back from adversity and maintain a positive mental attitude when, you know, things aren't necessarily going the way they expect them to.
A little bit of healthy paranoia, man. I love that. I think it's so true in life and in business. You got to constantly evolve, adapt, learn new things to survive and really thrive. Brent, it's been an awesome interview, man. I really appreciate you coming on. Is there a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out this awesome book, which I can't wait to dive into myself?
Thanks. No, it's just... you know, I think that, you know, appropriate for the audience, and I'm honored to have been a part of this. Just really, I think that, you know, the most successful people out there embody these principles personally as well. You know, discipline and accountability and trustworthiness and resilience and grit. And that's what, because nobody's perfect. We all make mistakes. Those mistakes are typically costly, whether it be professionally, personally. We all deal with adversity and change and you know, I was a full-time single parent for 4 years before I met my wife, Nicole. And it's, you know, I had to really lean into some of these principles, even though I lost sight of the vision every now and then. But it's really just kind of taking these to heart and learning how to be resilient and maintain positivity through all of life's many challenges. But really, really appreciate it. One thing I did want to mention that, you know, my book, Taking Point, which is a bestseller, and it was the number one new release in organizational change. But more importantly, a large majority of the proceeds are supporting the Seal Family Foundation. I'm on the executive board, and we support family resilience and the families of our active duty and fallen special warfare operators. My website's BrentGleasonSpeaker.com, and I just want to say thank you one more time. Really appreciate being on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks again for coming on. Really do appreciate your time. And thanks again for your service. I really do appreciate that. I try to say that as much as I can and, you know, have someone like you on the show. The sacrifice you make is truly incredible and much appreciated. Guys, make sure you check that book out. Not only is it an incredibly interesting book, as you can tell from this interview, but also it benefits a great cause as well. So get your hands on that. Check it out. Brent, thanks again for coming on, man. Really do appreciate it. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.